Let's welcome Professor Thorsten Joachim.
Thank you very much. So, it was about 20 years ago and that was well before I arrived at Cornell, that my faculty colleagues started to realize that the world of computing was changing. Computers used to be something that happened in the office or happened in a lab, but all of a sudden, it was moving into our living rooms. We had these systems now where computers and humans were interacting and becoming computational and human systems. And if you think about it, what we have today, we have all of these social networks, we have search engine recommendation systems. And it's really about the interactions of human and system that makes these systems work. This is how the Department of Information Science was born at Cornell. And the story that I'm going to tell today during my talk is really one of the stories of information science. It's about humans and machines kind of interacting in a productive way. So, the types of systems that I want to think about are these learning systems that use machine learning and interact with users and learn from their users. Recommendation systems, search engines, smart homes, and many, many other systems that fall into this category. And really, if you think about it, these systems get their knowledge from their users. Like a recommendation system, like the movie recommendation system Netflix, has not seen any of the movies. But it knows a lot about movies by using machine learning based on the star ratings that many, many people give to the movies to actually acquire a lot of knowledge about the world. Or think about a search engine like Google. Such a search engine would constantly like to monitor how well it's doing based on the clicks that people make. And it would like to update its ranking function and improve. And of course, there's personalization, right? We always want to personalize to the users, make the system smarter. And I'd say, actually, if you want to have a shot of creating more and more intelligent systems, it's about really gathering as much intelligence from as many people as possible. So this is what this talk is going to be about, these types of systems. And on a very abstract level, there are these systems which kind of follow in this loop, right? You have the user giving a command X, like a query in a search engine. The search engine responds with ranking Y, and the user then gives some feedback in forms of clicks, pre-reformulations that tells the search engine how well it's doing. And overall, in this loop, everybody has the interest of increasing the utility that the system provides to the user. Now, the argument that I want to make here is, to make these systems work, it's equally important to not just think about the machine learning algorithm, but to actually think about where your data comes from. I mean, much of the big data that we collect today and that we've heard about today really comes from this type of interaction loop in our systems, right? But if we are not careful about thinking about how we gather this data, we'll gather a lot of junk. But what we really want is we want to have good data that actually answers the question and gains us the knowledge that we want to have. So what this talk is about is mostly really about the user part of machine learning, right? How do we get good data from the user? In particular, how do we get meaningful data? How do we get unbiased data? And how do we get more data? And there are many situations where we really need more data. Let me start with the first question, getting meaningful data. Here's the simplest problem that you may have when you're a search engine. You have two retrieval functions, retrieval function 1, retrieval function 2. And you want to find out which one is better. So there's a distribution of users, for example, me coming to the search engine, issuing my favorite query SVM. And ranking function 1 gives me that ranking as a certain utility to me. Ranking function 2 gives me that ranking as a certain utility to me. Now I want to find out which of the two ranking functions provides higher retrieval quality on average. So the first thought that you may have is, well, let's do an A-B test. Half of my users get this retrieval function, half get that retrieval function. And then we measure some statistics that are hopefully correlated with the thing that we want to improve, retrieval quality. So, people have thought about things like abandonment rate, like the number of queries that don't get any clicks, the number of clicks per query, where in the ranking people click, how long it takes people to click. And ideally, we want to find out whether any of these statistics is actually indicative of retrieval quality, right? Anybody have a guess? Is any of these statistics related to retrieval quality? Who thinks yes? Who thinks no? A lot of people don't know, which is exactly the point where we were as well. So we wanted to find out whether any of these statistics actually does work. So what we needed is we needed to run an experiment. And so we implemented our own search engine, which is the Archive Full Text Search. Archive is this repository of scientific papers that you may have used as well. And so we built the search engine. And one of my PhD students, Philip Rodlinski, he hand-tuned a retrieval function that gave different weights to like author matches versus title matches versus abstract matches. And that is our original retrieval function here. And at some point, Philip didn't know how to make it any better. But he knew how to make it worse. That's pretty easy, right? So what he did was he took two results from the top of the ranking and swapped them with two results from the bottom of the first page. And under very mild assumptions, that makes retrieval quality worse. And he did this even more with four swaps. So now we have, by construction, a retrieval function original that is better than swap two, that is better than swap four. We did this again, took the original retrieval function, threw away all of the field weights. That's flat, that makes it worse. And then we took the results from flat and randomized the order of the top 10. So we have another triple where we know by construction, original is better than flat, is better than randomized. And now we fielded these retrieval functions in a user study and collected all of these statistics. And here are the results. So down here, we have the different statistics. And here's the value of the statistic. And the blue bars here are the first triple of retrieval function where we know the order of retrieval quality. And the red bar is the second triple, again, of known retrieval quality. And these little whiskers on top indicate how you may have thought that these statistics change if you decrease retrieval quality. Well, if you look at that plot, they don't, right? There wasn't actually a single statistic that reliably reflected the known order of retrieval quality that we knew by construction. That's a bit of a bummer. But maybe we just didn't have enough data, right? We just had a few thousand queries, it's a small search engine. Maybe if we had not thousands of queries, but tenth of millions of queries, maybe then it would work, right? Chappelle and others actually did a very similar study on the Yahoo search engine with tens of millions of queries, but essentially came to the same conclusion. There wasn't a single statistic that very kind of in a satisfactory way reflected retrieval quality. I mean, some of these statistics are useful for other purposes, but they don't reflect retrieval quality by themselves. Okay. So back to the drawing board. So what should we actually do if you want to decide whether one retrieval function is better than another? I'd argue that, well, the first thing that we should really think about is if you want to measure something about clicks, we should actually really think about how do people make clicks, right? What's the connection between utility that we want to measure or retrieval quality and the action that we can observe, the clicks? And that gets us into models of choice and into microeconomics. So the basic model of choice from microeconomics is that of rational choice. So rational choice says if you have a set of alternatives, then you can model people's behavior as if they were maximizing some utility function that's underlying. So basically, they would look at all the options, and then they pick the one that has the highest value to them. Utility. Now, for web search, that's a little far-fetched, right? People are making the decision to click under time constraints, and they, you know, you're just looking at the abstracts there, so really you only have an approximate notion of utility. So if you have kind of constraints on this rational choice model, you would call it a bounded rational choice model. And that probably fits more better, what we actually have in web search here. And then there are a lot of behavioral issues that also bias the selection that people make, like framing, fairness, loss aversion, lots more. But let's ignore those for now, because these bounded rationality models are actually going to be quite useful, as we'll see. Okay, so what is a reasonable bounded rationality model for web search, how people click in search? So here's a very simple model. People read the results from top to bottom, and we've actually done eye tracking studies. That's not a bad approximation of how people scan the results. And then at some point they stop, and we don't know where they stop. And it's hard to predict where they stop. But once they observe the top K results, whatever that K may be, they actually make a kind of approximate rational choice among the options that they've observed. So if this is our model of how people make clicks, things like number of clicks doesn't actually have a meaning, right? So how should we then design these statistics? Or even better, I mean, think about it. We are the search engine. We can actually intervene, and we have complete control over what the user sees. So we can adapt the interface to gather the data that we want. So it's about 10 years ago, or more, 14 years ago, that I introduced this technique of interleaving. Interleaving is the following. You want to decide whether one retrieval function is better than another. What you do is you don't do A-B test, but you give everybody an interleaved ranking. So this interleaved ranking is constructed by taking the top K results from each of the two rankings and merging them together, and then presenting the interleaved ranking to the user. The user doesn't know where the results came from. And so in this sense, it's a blind test. Then you can check, you can see where the user clicks in this ranking, and you can trace this back to where these clicks came from. So here the user clicked on 1, 3, and 7 in the interleaved ranking. And you can see for ranking function 1, there was only one of the results in the top 4. And for ranking function 2, there were 3 results in the top 4. So ranking function 2 produced more relevant results than ranking function 1, and you could say it won this pairwise comparison. And now we can do this over a whole distribution of queries and get a noisy kind of binary preference that tells you then, kind of in aggregate, which ranking function is better. Does that actually work? So use the same retrieval system, same experiment setup, but now we did this interleaving comparison, and that's the conditions that people were assigned to. And here are results. Here are the different pairs that are being interleaved. And I've organized, and this is the value, it's the percentage wins of the retrieval function in this interleaved comparison. And I've always organized it so that the number of wins of the red bar here, corresponds to the better retrieval function that we know is better by construction, and the blue is the inferior retrieval function. So all the red bars are actually significantly higher than all the blue bars. So interleaving actually perfectly reproduces the order of retrieval quality that we knew was correct by construction. Now you may say, well, this was archive search. This was scientists, very rational people, searching for papers to read, right? Does that actually work in a different environment as well? So at this point, there are published studies both on Bing as well as on Yahoo that this also works for regular web search. So now we're in a position where we can actually start thinking about the machine learning algorithm, right? We actually have a reliable way of getting meaningful data. And this was precisely the point where we were 6 years ago, and we designed what we call the dueling bandit setting of how do we do online learning from these paired comparisons, right? If I have now K retrieval functions and I want to find the best one, how do I schedule these pairwise comparisons to most efficiently find the best one? And at this point, there's actually a whole bunch of algorithms for solving this problem. But that's not what I want to focus on in this talk. Let me skip these algorithms, because the key point that I want to make here is that a lot of machine learning, if you're thinking about these human interactive systems, happens well before you run the machine learning algorithm, right? It's actually about gathering the right data. And once you have the right data, the rest kind of becomes automatic. So this was kind of an example of how I think we should be designing these systems, right? We start with a model of how people behave, how the actions that we can observe are connected to the underlying thing that we want to extract, the knowledge that we want to extract, utility. And once we have a plausible model of how that's happening and an accurate model of how that's happening, then we have to design the interface, and we can make interventions in designing this interface, like interleaving, to gather the data that we want, and then we can design the machine learning algorithm. It's not just about big data. It's about getting the right data and getting meaningful data. So this kind of dueling bandit setup is great if you have a few options that you want to kind of winnow down to the best. But there's a lot more settings in which we want to use kind of interactive learning with users. For example, in personalization and in recommendation. And, you know, this dueling bandit setup doesn't really work there. So let me kind of do another pass, basically through the same argument, but from a recommendation perspective that's more suitable to recommendation. So this is my Netflix page. And what Netflix does is it gives me these recommendations of things that I would like to watch. So Netflix, things that I most like to watch Lewis Black. Now, the way that I pick a movie to watch or a show to watch on any particular night is, well, I look at these recommendations, but I don't just blindly follow the recommendation of the system, but I browse around. I'd go like, oh, Lie to Me, that kind of looks interesting. And I click on that, and at the bottom of the page, there's more shows like Lie to Me, and I would browse around for 5 minutes. And at the end of these 5 minutes, I would pick the show to watch that I like best. Right? And let's say in this case it was Awake. So the way you can think about this as a boundedly rational choice model is that given the set of all movies that Netflix has, the algorithm started me out at a particular point. That's the recommendation it made, Lewis Black. Then I explored part of the collection in a self-directed way. And then I made a utility maximizing choice of picking the Y bar that I like best. So the way that you interpret that as feedback is that Y bar has at least slightly higher utility than the Y that the system, the recommendation that the system gave to me to start out with. But note that this Y bar is not the optimal prediction. The optimal prediction may be something that I haven't seen during my session, right? So I can't assume that this Y star is, you know, that we actually get this Y star, which is the optimal prediction. So we call this the coactive feedback model. Always get a slight improvement to the prediction that the system made. You can think about it in the same way also about other kind of settings. So for example, let's take web search again. Let's say we see the user clicking on this link. Then it's fair to assume that if he constructed a ranking where this link was promoted by one position, the user would have liked this ranking better than the ranking that we actually did present, right? So we again have a pairwise preference, but the user gives us a Y bar, a slightly improved ranking, over the ranking that the system presented. Or think about machine translation. So I'm from Germany, my parents speak only German, and so I often have pieces of English text that I want to translate for them into German. So the easiest way to do this is to copy-paste this into Google Translate. And here's the German translation that Google Translate gives. Anybody reads German? It's not a good translation. It actually doesn't get the same meaning across as this piece of text. So what I would typically do is I would fix it up, right? I would fix it up just enough so that it becomes understandable. This is by no means the optimal translation. It's not beautiful. But it's a better translation than what the system originally predicted, right? So we again have this coactive feedback setting where this Y bar that the system, that the user constructed for me is slightly better than the prediction that the system made. So, can we design algorithms that work with this feedback that's different from supervised feedback? Supervised learning feedback in the traditional setting assumes that we get the Y star, the optimal label, right? Can we also design algorithms that make do with these much weaker labels, Y bar, that are just a slight improvement over the prediction that the system has made? And the answer is yes. There are very simple algorithms. So the simplest one we could come up with is a perceptron. But you can do the same trick for, you know, if you want to do a deep neural net, you can do that as well. So basically, you just do a perceptron update with this Y bar, not the optimal label, but just the slight improvement. And so that's the key difference, right? The feedback is different. It's not the correct class label here. And also the way that we're going to evaluate the system's performance is different. We can't talk about misclassification rate anymore, but we have to now talk about some kind of measure of how much, in terms of utility, are we predicting in a suboptimal way. And so we defined this notion of regret. Regret is a kind of way of measuring over time how suboptimal a system actually is. And regret is something that you want to decay to zero or to some small value over time as the system learns, that it approaches optimal predictions. So the regret is defined as take the utility of the optimal thing that the system could have done and subtract the utility of the action that the system actually took, right? And hopefully the difference isn't too large. So that's going to be our notion of quality of the system. It seems like a strong notion of quality because in our setup, you know, the cardinal utilities, utility values, we never actually observe. Nevertheless, we kind of evaluate our system by it. And we also typically don't get the Y star here that we're benchmarking ourselves against. Well, it turns out it's actually pretty easy to derive theorems that characterize the regret, the expected regret of this very simple perceptron algorithm. And so this is the bound. And you know, if you have seen the perceptron and if you have seen perceptron bounds, you will recognize this. If you don't, haven't seen this, doesn't matter that much. You have this second term here, which is a margin term, R times W, which you always have in these perceptron style bounds. It's the norm of the weight, optimal weight vector. And that decays to zero at 1 over square root of the number of training examples that you have, number of iterations that you learn. That's very much like a regular perceptron. And then up here, you have a term that characterizes how good your feedback is. And that's what it asymptotes to. So let me explain to you how you measure the quality of the feedback. So we have this definition of psi approximately alpha informative feedback. That was a mouthful of a name, so we should have come up with something better. But instead of, you know, telling you what this formula actually means here, that's the formal definition, let me tell you in terms of a picture what this definition of feedback quality means. So here we have the utility scale, and at the top end, we have the optimal prediction. That's the thing that gets you the maximum utility, the best prediction. The system's prediction is somewhere below there, typically, right? And then what we wanted in our coactive learning setup is that the user's Y bar, the user's feedback, is, you know, somewhere to the right here, right? Somewhere between the system's prediction and the optimal prediction. And it could be stochastic, right? So sometimes the user actually gives us feedback that's worse than the prediction that the system made, right? But what we require is that in expectation, the user's feedback is better than what the system presented. And to measure how much it is better, we use this factor alpha, indicated by this green region here, showing you kind of a relative improvement over shrinking this gap between system prediction and optimal. Now, sometimes we'll also be in a situation where even in expectation, the feedback is worse than what the system presented. And in those cases, this kind of loss in utility, in expected utility, that's exactly the xi that goes into this bound here. So as long as the xi's are small, the coactive preference perceptron is going to converge to a very good solution. Okay, so we have a very simple, nice algorithm. Let's try it out. So we're going back to our archive full-text search engine. And so we came up with a retrieval function that had about 1,000 features and about, it was a linear weighting, so 1,000 parameters, a weight vector to tune, and that's what we used this coactive preference perceptron for. And the way that we constructed feedback was exactly the same as we had on the previous slide. So if somebody clicked a link in position in this position, we constructed the feedback ranking as the ranking that you get if you promote that link by one position. We had to do evaluation, right? We actually wanted to know whether the learning system is actually improving. So the way that we did that is that in every odd iteration, we did coactive learning, did the perceptron. But then in every even iteration, we took the current learned system and interleaved its prediction, or its ranking, with the baseline, with the baseline ranker, this original ranker that we had before, this hand-tuned ranker. So that in every second iteration, we could basically check whether we're doing better or how much better or how much worse we're doing than the baseline. And ideally, we'd then see that over time, we start beating the baseline more and more and more, right? That was our idea. Here's what happened. This is the number of feedback iterations of the coactive preference perceptron. This is the win ratio. The win ratio of one is losing as often as you win against the baseline. So it doesn't work, right? It just, you know, it hovers around the baseline. It doesn't actually improve over the baseline. And in hindsight, we should have seen this coming. We had the theory to actually realize that we may be in for a problem. And let me explain to you what the problem is. This is this alpha informative feedback. And you know, here we have a system prediction that's pretty far from the optimal prediction. And now it's pretty easy for the user to give us a feedback ranking that's actually an improvement. But if we move closer to optimal with our predictions, it gets harder and harder to actually come up with an improved ranking. And if we move really close, then we are starting to incur these slacks. And the reason why we incur these slacks is the following. I mean, think about it. If this is the close to optimal ranking here, and users are just a little bit noisy in how they click, then there are a lot of links that they can click on that make this ranking worse, kind of point the coactive preference perceptron in the wrong direction, and only a few links that they can click on to give you an improved ranking. So if the noise level in your clicks is sufficiently high, which it probably is in web search, right, then you get this long tail here of all of the rankings that are actually worse than what the system predicted, and we get this shift where the expected feedback actually is quite bad. Now, what would we really want? We would like to shape this feedback so that the distribution looks more like this, that we cut off this kind of nasty tail of all of the bad rankings and all of the noise that the users give back to us. And the idea here is, again, not to kind of mess with the learning algorithm, but to actually think about how do we get better data from the user, cleaner data from the user. So here's how we can do it. It's called fair pair, and it's very simple. So instead of presenting just the ranking as the search engine outputs it, what you do is you take adjacent pairs, and you flip them with probability 50%. And then you only create a feedback ranking if the user clicks at the bottom of one of these pairs. Now think about it. Each of the elements of the pair has the same probability of being in the bottom of the pair. If the users act completely randomly, we're going to generate feedback in both directions of the pair with an equal probability. In expectation, they're actually going to cancel out. So that means, kind of in the worst case, if users are completely random, we still only get feedback that kind of keeps us at the position where we currently are in the coactive preference perspective, because errors cancel out, noise cancels out, if you collect data in this fashion. But if users are just a little bit rational, if they just are slightly more likely to click on the more relevant results, we actually get alpha informative feedback that points us in the right direction. So here's the same experiment. And the only exchange that we did was we introduced this fair pair perturbation in selecting, in collecting the data. And now the system, even just after a few hundred learning steps, is already substantially better than the baseline, and it keeps improving. So it was again about collecting the way that we collected the data, making interventions into the interface that gave us cleaner data that our learning algorithm had a much easier time learning with. So this is the plot that is in the ICML paper, and it's the all of the data that we had by the submission deadline. But actually, about a year later, Karthik Raman, who was the lead student on this paper, was in my office, and we were thinking about a different experiment to run on the full text search engine. And at some point, we wondered, wait, did you ever turn off that experiment? And he was like, I don't know, probably not. So, and indeed, it wasn't turned off, it was running the whole time. So Karthik went and collected all of the data that the system had accumulated over the year, and this is what it did. So it just kept improving and then kind of converging to some very high rate of beating the baseline. I've tried to build kind of real-world learning systems that can live in the world and autonomously learn in the world and be intelligent in the world for a long time. And most of the systems worked, but they all required kind of careful maintenance and feeding and, you know, once in a while a little, you know, careful tuning. This is the first system that I could actually literally forget for a year and come back and see that it performed just fine. So that really kind of made me convinced that if I have the right model of user behavior and I collect the data in the right way for the proper learning algorithm, that I can build these very robust systems that can live and learn autonomously in the world without human intervention. So that was the second kind of episode here, where it really went from coming up with a good model of how people make decisions and how that's connected to utility, the underlying knowledge that people have, and then designing the learning algorithm and the interface for collecting the data in a way that actually goes together well and that gives you reliable learning results. So let me get to the last one. And this is about getting more data. We live in an era of big data, but there's tons of problems where we still don't have enough data. So one of these problems is that of session-based recommendation. So it's different from long-term recommendation, where you have like a long-term profile of what you generally like. And session-based recommendation is like the task of, you know, which movie should I watch tonight? There's only one movie that I can watch. And for tonight, there's a lot of hidden context. You know, which mood am I in tonight? Am I watching this movie with a friend? Do I have 1 or 2 hours, right? All of this is hidden from the recommendation algorithm. And you would want to use a session-based recommendation algorithm to quickly get this information within this one session to then adapt the recommendations that you give. You know, don't recommend 2-hour movies if the person has only 1 hour of time to watch, right? So Tobias Schnabel, Paul Bennett, and Sue Dumais had this brilliant insight of how we could actually get more data for this kind of session-based recommendation. And before I tell you what that brilliant idea was, let me tell you what you're typically dealing with. So this is an interface for, you know, as you would see it in Netflix or in Amazon as well, for selecting movies. You can browse through the movies. You can, you know, click on a movie and explore more information about it, like who's the director and so on. And then eventually, you choose one movie to play. So they did a user study where they gave people this interface, very standard interface, and then collected all of the feedback that they got. In particular, you can treat, you know, getting more information about the movie as a positive signal that this movie is something that they were considering, that they, that was interesting to them, right? So we have positive feedback of movies they explored and movies that they saw but that they skipped, that they didn't interact with. And this interface, this is basically the only type of kind of feedback data that you have. So they trained a ranking SVM based on this feedback data. And then to test how well this predicts, we took the movie that the user actually chose in the end and embedded it in 99 other random movies. And then we had the ranking SVM predict which of these 100 movies was the one that the user chose. Basically, it was a ranking task, so rank the chosen movie as high to the top as possible. And here are the results. This is mean reciprocal rank. It's a measure of how well it ranks. And you get a tiny improvement from learning, right? If you take a random ranking, that gives you a mean reciprocal rank of 0.052. If you do this learning, you get it 0.063. Not very impressive. And the reason is simple, right? An average session had only 2.75 movies that it had positive feedback on. And that's just not a lot of data for a machine learning algorithm to deal with, any machine learning algorithm. So here's the idea that Tobias, Paul, and Sue had. There's research from psychology, or theory from psychology, that suggests that for people to keep things in short-term memory is actually work. It's cost. And we are not very good at keeping things in short-term memory. So they came up with the idea of providing a shortlist to the user. So a shortlist being a kind of short-term digital memory where people could, you know, add movies that they would like to have under consideration for this one session. And then they could later go back and, you know, make a final selection from these movies. A very, you know, very interesting but very simple idea, right? Now we have three questions. The first question is, you know, was this psychological theory actually right? Do users appreciate this kind of digital short-term memory that helps them augment their abilities to keep track of things within one session? Second question is, do they actually make use of the shortlist so that we get more data? And the final question is, does this additional data actually get us better retrieval quality? So let's start with the first question. In this user study, the subjects were exposed to both interfaces, the one without the shortlist and with the shortlist. And after the study was over, they were asked which of the two interfaces they preferred. And as you can see, they had a very strong preference for the shortlist. They actually really liked the shortlist. And there were a lot of interesting quotes, people explaining their choice here, why they what they prefer. And this was a particularly nice one. In each round, it really made me confident that I wasn't losing track of a good movie in the shifting sands of my short-term memory. Very poetic. So people liked the interface. Interestingly, if you ask them, you know, how satisfied are you with the choices, the movies that you actually selected when you were under these two conditions, the two different interfaces, they also strongly prefer the movies that they selected when they had the shortlist available. Right? So the user thought that they were making better decisions with the shortlist. Okay, so that's good. So people like it. does this liking it actually translate into using it? And the answer is a pretty clear yes. So in 93% of the sessions where a shortlist was available, people actually did use the shortlist. And that roughly doubled the amount of data that the recommendation algorithm had available, right? So if you take now examined and shortlisted, both as positive signals, the amount of data, positive data that you have actually doubles. If you now give this to a ranking SVM and train them on both kind of sorts of positive data, you actually also get basically a doubling in the mean reciprocal rank. So you're doubling in this sense the recommendation performance as well. So this was yet another example where you're going from understanding people's decision processes, here in a sense of a cognitive limitation that they have, designing the interface with the purpose of collecting the right and the right amount of data. So let me wrap up. I think all of these three examples are kind of making the point that if you want to build these intelligent systems that gather intelligence from their users and augment and really kind of make an effort to go towards gathering more and more real-world knowledge that makes these systems more and more intelligent, I think it's equally important to think about all three components of this machine learning system. Without any of these components, none of this would have worked. And the first one is, of course, that if we wanted to learn from user behavior, we have to have a reasonable model how, in that particular situation, the observable actions are connected to utility, to the knowledge that we want to get from the user. And utility basically encodes the knowledge in an actionable way of biases and limitations that people have to augment their abilities. Then we need to design, based on these insights, we need to design the interface. And we can do interventions like interleaving or fair pair to get the data that we want. We can shape the data distribution. And with the wrong data, no learning algorithm is going to work. So we have to get the right data. And so we have to worry about these two things. And then finally, we can think about the learning algorithm. But as I've tried to make the point here in this talk, really much of the action happens well before you actually start with the learning algorithm. So this is really a way of getting large-scale data, much larger than you could ever get by hand labeling, directly from the users. And I think this is an interesting path to building these intelligent systems. It's also an interesting example of what information science means, right? It's this idea that, or this necessity actually, that to make these computational systems work, you have to think about your users. You have to think about humans. And this relates to all of these different other disciplines, all of which were relevant in making these systems work. Thank you very much.